like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Tampa native Dr. Danny McVitie, a veterinarian who's the co-founder of Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice, which in less than a decade has grown into the nation's largest network dedicated solely to end-of-life veterinary care. Dr. McVitie was a guest on the show about 5 years ago before her empire had fully taken flight, but our family recently said goodbye to a much-beloved dog, and I couldn't help but notice that around that time, some Facebook friends and other friends were saying goodbye to their beloved pets, and you know, every day somebody's unfortunately going through that. So, and anyone who's experienced that type of loss knows it's singularly wrenching and heartbreaking. But anyone who has pets, other than maybe certain kind of birds, recognizes also that the life expectancies of dogs and cats and others is such that we will say goodbye to our animals, maybe multiple times over our lifetime. So Dr. McVitie is a nationally recognized expert in this realm and can help guide many of us through that sort of grief now or later, and also assist those grappling with the difficult issues of an elderly or ill animal when to say goodbye. So we'll delve into that and more when I speak with Dr. Danny McVitie in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Paul Knapp, who for years has recorded whale sounds, whale singing, no less, in the Caribbean and elsewhere. I'll chat with Paul about those experiences, and we'll hear some whale sounds. Lastly, it's incumbent on me to mention that the WMNF Summer Fun Drive starts tomorrow, June 1st. By way of reminder, I have once again been asked to raise $3,000 in less than an hour, so I hope you'll consider making an early pledge. It's really simple to do. Just go to talkinganimals.net, and all the information for pledging, including donating via the Talking Animals tip jar, is spelled out there. And in that same section of talkinganimals.net, you can also see the exclusive thank you gifts for pledges of various levels I'll be offering. You can only get these by supporting Talking Animals directly. These thank you gifts include the brand new Talking Animals t-shirt, which, in keeping with the national, maybe international feelings about our president, its policies and actions, depicts animals protesting. And at least imagines what these what things they might protest and what their protest signs might look like. So you can see what the shirt looks like front and back on TalkingAnimals.net. Other Talking Animals thank you gifts include amazing tickets, one pair of amazing tickets to see Paul McCartney, July 10th at the Amalie Arena, and a week-long stay at the condo on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, two signed copies of A Dog's Way Home, the new novel by best-selling author Bruce Cameron, course wrote A Dog's Purpose, which was recently made into a film. So again, all details on all these gifts and how to help support the show and me can be found at talkinganimals.net. Right now, though, let's get to Dr. McVitie and the ways she can help us. So with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Danny McVitie back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. McVitie.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And we got the whole entourage here in the studio, so it's all very exciting. Mm-hmm. So we last stood face-to-face in the studio 5 years ago when Lap of Love was a fairly new enterprise and small, kind of finding its way, but already growing then. So I'm going to spend most of our time, obviously, today addressing end-of-life issues for pets, questions about euthanasia, when, where, how, and presumably we'll take some questions from listeners by phone and email and text. But before that, let's review the Lap of Love history, extending back even before our last interview 5 years ago. Talk about the very beginning of the company. What prompted you to start it?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up here in Tampa, so coming back home was a no-brainer for me. So I was doing emergency medicine at Tampa Bay Veterinary Emergency Services over on Bears Avenue. And there was this one night when a lady walked in and she had her little chihuahua wrapped in a little blanket. And she looked at me and we knew it was time for her chihuahua to say goodbye. And she said, "Can you just not take him off my lap?" I just don't want him off my lap this entire time. I don't want him on this cold, sterile table. And of course, in vet school, we're taught we take him to the back, we place an IV catheter, and then we bring them back into the room with the family. But I looked at her and I thought to myself, why not? Why not give her exactly what she was requesting? So I did, and I just kind of, you know, maneuvered the procedure around exactly what she asked. And she walked out of the clinic in the same exact way that she walked in, which was her little pet wrapped up in a blanket on her lap, in her arms. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I wanted a word, lap of love. You know, mm-hmm. I knew like that. I already had this idea, this concept. And keep in mind, I'm like maybe weeks out of school at this point, out of veterinary school. But I already had this idea in my mind based on the human hospice volunteer work that I'd done in college and how human hospice treats sickness and death not as a failure of medicine, but as the natural progression of biology. And that's not necessarily something that we're taught in medical school. We're taught cure, 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 fight, 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 war on cancer. And you want that in oncologists. You know, you want that type of fighting mentality. But human hospice, and particularly when it gets to emergency medicine, a lot of times there's nothing more that we can do other than say goodbye peacefully. So I started tapping into those skills that I learned as a volunteer. And when that woman, when I saw her walk out, I just knew, gosh, I wish I knew who that was.
Such a powerful moment. Yeah.
And I knew I wanted the word love in it. And of course, if you Google Lab of Love 8 years ago, we were not the service that would come up. It would be different things that would come up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Kind of racy things, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea at the time. But it really just kind of developed into this way of treating people and their pets, which was, you come in on Friday, you know your pet has a terminal illness, but mom, dad, husband, wife, son, daughter don't get home until Sunday. And can we hospice this family and the pet for a day or two simply until we're able to say goodbye in the most peaceful way? And that time, even if it was 24 or 48 hours or a week or more, that time just gave that family the ability to come to grips with what was happening. And then the experience with death was so much different than it was on the other side.
So what year was this when that experience with the woman and the chihuahua on the lap happened?
It was the end of 2009. And okay. I graduated in May of 2009 from University of Florida.
Wow. Okay. So you were a pup. Yeah. So, or a kitten, whatever. But okay. So now, fast forward 8 years later, tell me, like, how many states Lap of Love is in? How many vets work for Lap of Love? To give me the scorecard at this point.
Yeah, about a year later after I started, I partnered with a classmate of mine, Dr. Mary Gardner, and she had 10 years in software before veterinary school. So we partnered together. We developed a software system that was going to help us scale it, and it was obvious. I had doctors calling me around the country saying, "How do I do what you're doing? How do mm-hmm. I do this?" There was just nothing else like it. It wasn't that I was doing something that you know better than anybody else. I was doing something no one else was doing.
Right, you were doing it first.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so literally now it's been 8 years later, almost 8 years later, and we have over 100 doctors that work with us around the country.
And how many states is that scattered over those 100 doctors?
Almost 30 states. So I believe we're about 26 states.
So looking back, given that kind of growth over, again, a fairly short period of time, can you point to a certain moment or milestone where you thought, hey, this is going to work. I'm onto something here.
Yes. I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine, Amanda, probably about 6 or 8 weeks out of school. And I'd already had this idea and concept. And as an entrepreneur, I don't ask a lot of people their opinions or feedbacks many times, particularly at the very beginning, because you have to have this very pure vision of what you're
doing.
Right,
and just stay on track.
You can't be a mosaic of everybody else's ideas. You have to have this core thought process of what it is. And I talked to her, and her face lit up when I said something. And I knew, I'm like, if 1/10 of the people out there could light up with this type of idea, this is something that's going to mean something. Before I started doing emergency medicine, I knew what the value of it was going to be.
Sure. Well, from an outsider's perspective, I mean, like you said, you were kind of first, but I think it's that classic combination of a great idea whose time had come, and then obviously stellar execution, right, by the right person or the right people, even in the early days, and that's why it took off the way it did.
Everything.
It was all those things, right?
Yeah. And even if you look at euthanasia or even hospice care, you know, my profession has been doing it for generations. We just haven't had the ability and the mindset and then really the consumer demand to fraction it into its own way of practicing medicine.
Right. Yeah. And some of that, something I was going to ask you about later, but that in some ways that ties into, I just think in the last generation or two, there's been such an explosion in the number of pets in households. So I think that enabled you on the one hand to fractionalize it, as you say, but also I think there's an attitudinal shift that goes with that, right? Isn't there that years ago, somebody would lose a pet and comparatively speaking, it was more rare. So people would say, well, you know, why are you all upset? Like if they weren't pet people, they weren't animal people. They say, you know, what's all the fuss? Why are you making such a big deal about it? Now, I think I got to believe, and you would know a lot better than I, that would be a pretty rare reaction, that most people now, there's so many people with animals, and if they're not there, at least they're exposed to people who do have them, that they would not say, why are you so upset, or why are you so sad, or whatever.
Absolutely. People get it. I mean, imagine 60, 70 years ago, if you were to say to somebody, look, my dog's going to be sleeping in my bed. You know, the next generation will have their dog. I mean, I grew up on a farm. We had farm dogs. They were outside dogs. They were outside cats. Fantastic life. But literally, our animals have gone from the barnyard to our living room to our bedroom to our beds. I don't know. Like, my dog sleeps under the sheets. So, I mean, literally, like, they have made that transition.
Sure.
And even in my profession, we started hundreds of years ago as mechanics. We were the ones who fixed the ox and the horses that pulled carts to the market that took us into war. You know, that's what my profession started as. But we are now more like pediatricians than we are the mechanics.
Interesting. Yeah.
And we're even developing into a different sector of that where, you know, our children are supposed to grow up and be independent of us. We're supposed to teach them independence. They're supposed to, you know, move on.
Yeah.
But our pets never do. They're dependent on us forever. So there's this new sector that you know, and really it's how important pets have become in our family. And that's the main underlying factor with all of our, the clients and the families that ask us for help. It has nothing to do with income. It has nothing to do with where they live. It's all about whether or not they treat their pets as family. That's it. We've been to homeless shelters. I've literally euthanized pets at homeless shelters because that is how important their pet was to them.
Right. Well, in some cases, people would say if you're part of the homeless community and you're somehow managed to have an animal, they're more important than for many of us that obviously do live in homes.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's their one sort of close bond and relationship. So, because even 5 years ago, I remember that people called in and emailed to sing your praises, and when it was still kind of not in the infancy, but it was still pretty early on then. And clearly, that's been repeated umpteen times, and in a ripple effect, right? So now, if you're in 30 states, I mean, people are seeing more and more. This is how I wanna, when that dreadful time comes, this is how I want to be able to respond.
Yeah. So. And it's that it's the thing that people do right after. And even when I'm coaching someone through the decision making, I always say, like, you know, this isn't something that you want to hear right now, but I'm going to tell you anyway. And it's the relief that you're going to feel afterwards. And it's not it's nothing but a relief that they're out of pain. They're not feeling badly anymore.
Right.
And I think that coaching somebody through, we can go into that more about how and what words we use. But the coaching part of it has that person feel at the end of it either guilt from the decision that was made or relief that the pet is out of suffering.
And we will go into that. One other thing along these lines, though, just because we talked about the testimonials and things or people calling in 5 years ago, and even just in a brief Facebook post last night when I said that you're going to be on the show, a number of people weighed in like, oh, Dr. McVitie was great, or yeah, we used Lap of Love recently and just got us through an unbearable time. And
again, it is everything to me. I wish the government would accept thank you cards for my student loan payments because it would be everything.
Well,
that's the currency.
And speaking of that, you know? Am I right in remembering that part of the reason you launched Lap of Love was at the time kind of like almost like a side endeavor to help pay off?
Oh yeah, it was
loans?
A side thing.
Yeah,
oh, I was
but it was also partly like, hey, I've got these towering student loans things. Yeah. Here's one idea where I could chip away at it. Right?
Yeah, our profession has the highest student debt and the lowest starting salary.
Yeah,
but we do it because we love it.
And speaking of Facebook, I should note that we are. On Facebook Live with our interview with Dr. McVitie. And again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Danny McVitie, a Tampa native and veterinarian who co-founded Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice, the nation's largest network dedicated solely to end-of-life veterinary care. If you'd like to ask Dr. McVitie a question or offer a comment, perhaps about challenges you're facing with your animal, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Yeah, so we've kind of established the context of the business and how it's grown monstrously, exponentially. So let's delve into some of the end-of-life issues at the core of what Lap of Love does. So I think I mentioned when I was contacting you, what spurred me partly to seek this interview is that we recently experienced a difficult animal loss in our family, not that there's any other kind. Mm-hmm. And again, within a day or two, some Facebook friends and other friends went through same kind of losses. And I thought, again, somebody everywhere is experiencing this every day. So I just thought some specific examples might help us provide some general help to people doing that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the dog that we just lost. It was my mother-in-law's beloved Monty, a Yorkie, 16 years, and she's with him, and she joked that it was her longest relationship ever.
But, absolutely.
So part of the thing that I wanted to talk to you about that we struggle with is, I think everybody struggles with, when is it time?
Right.
But in Monty's case, he was declining in various ways that were obvious, kidney functioning and often disoriented and be up at night kind of wandering around. Just a lot of difficult things. It was difficult for her. But part of the issue for us was that he did not seem to be in physical pain. And we were periodically taking him to the vet to make sure that we were correct in that. And he was still eating. So the things that at least us lay people look for, like where, okay, maybe it's starting to be time, those weren't present. And yet he also seemed to be declining and near the end. We just didn't know how close the end was. So it was even harder to say, okay, just brutal, but it's time.
Right.
So how just generally would you respond to something where it's not as clear cut, like the symptoms aren't there as much, like, okay, this dog's suffering, or he's not eating anymore, or the cat's not eating anymore. What do we do now?
Right. Yeah. And you know, the number one thing that we look at when we're coaching somebody through this is the disease process that the pet is going through. So let's just take in this case that Monty had beautiful old age, is what I call it. Like, just, it's absolutely gorgeous. There isn't a condition like congestive heart failure, where when that, there's two functions, the two organs that will function until the moment that they don't, which is the heart and the brain. So anything having to do with the heart or the brain is not something that I allow a lot of levity in when having this tough conversation. But let's just take something like beautiful old age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the two things that we always want is that we want them to be happy, and then we want them to be out of pain. And then, of course, we can add in the eating part, because mm-hmm. that's just something as humans that we judge, you know, your ability to enjoy life.
Sure.
Kind of. You know,
of course.
It's just kind of a really weird thing that we do. But if you're eating, then you're enjoying life.
Right.
And at some point we have to look at, okay, we've sustained quality of life for so long. Now, how do we ensure a quality of death? So the most important question is, what do you want, you know, as a family? Do you want to come home and find him passed away, you know, on the kitchen floor? Is that what you want? And some people say, yes, I absolutely want that. And then the follow-up statement is, but do you worry if he's going to look for you? Would you be concerned that he was in a little bit of pain, even for 20, 30 minutes, maybe a couple of hours? You know, there's these things that we say we might want to come home and find them passed away. But yet when you really think about what that looks like, you may not want that. You may have more guilt attached to that. Now, there are some people that would be completely fine with that. And that's great. That's absolutely no problem. You know, we do also, and I want to preempt this conversation with the fact that we do sometimes forget that animals die all the time in the wild.
Sure.
All
course.
The time. We don't have to step in. We're not required to make this biological process happen or not happen. You know, birth is going to happen whether or not we step in or not, and death is going to happen whether or not we step in or not. So we don't have to have all this guilt attached to it. But that being said, we do have the ability to ensure a quality of death. So eating is important when it's important to the dog. So if you said that Monty was a picky eater all of his life, then I just don't care. As a veterinarian, I don't care if he's going to be eating or not.
Okay.
Now, if he loves eating, now all of a sudden he's stopped eating. Now
right.
That's a little bit
That's a red flag.
That's
but
a
we
red
were
flag.
Not, we didn't have that red flag, so that made it more of that horrible gray area.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the two other red flags that I'll say with old age is them going into different places. So if somebody calls me and says, he's under the coffee table, he's never gone under the coffee table, I don't know what's going on, so the zombie right there. You know, something has changed.
Does that suggest that the animal's disoriented, I mean, or just that their habits or something have shifted so radically that they've gone to a place that they've never been?
Both of those. We don't know exactly why, but
okay.
I think it has something to do with them being in pain and not really knowing how to handle it. It's some type of biological process where their body is shutting down, something's changing, and then they automatically want to just run away. And then that running away has them be away from the pack, so that when they do pass away, a predator is going to come get them, but not come get the pack.
Hmm.
This is just my theory. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, we'd have to prove that some other way. But those are just
those are
things that we've seen by the, you know, I've seen a lot of cases in a small amount of time. So that helps me see trends that we don't necessarily always see in the clinic.
Yeah. So that's where, again, the consultation
right.
of a lap of love that would really be crucial, or before that time. Whatever that animal's normal vet is you're sort of charting if they're ill and or elderly, kind of if they're declining, like what that decline looks like.
Yeah, and that's really the more important thing is what the trend has been with that pet. Have we had a trend that's going downhill pretty quickly? And the other statement is, you know, a lot of times it's just not going to get that much better. So many people will say, you know, I gave your number to so-and-so and he's going to call you when he's ready. I'm like, no, you don't call me when you're ready because you're never going to be ready.
Yeah.
You know, that's something our profession has done for many generations is go home, call me when you're ready. But it's because we haven't been coached through the process. You know, I had zero lectures on euthanasia 8 years ago when I graduated. Now Mary and I teach it at the University of Florida.
Right.
So now we're doing more.
Right.
But we didn't know. So we say, go home, call me when you're ready. But families don't know when they're ready. Shoot, I don't even know when I'm ready for my own pet. I have to have another veterinarian coach me through it.
Really?
Yeah. So you don't know when you're ready, but you can say, call me when you're ready to have the conversation because then I can coach you through what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. And that's on limitations.
Right.
And if you say, well, I don't want to make the decision, I say, you're not. I am. Well, I don't want to play God. You're not. I am. I'm the one that's done this thousands of times.
Right.
And I wouldn't do it if I didn't think that it was the very best thing that we can possibly do. So it's not you are making the right decision to the family. It's we together are making the best decision that we can possibly make.
But I think you make a couple of really important points, including that if you have been through it many, many, many times and you're obviously not as emotionally involved, even if maybe you know the family or the animal, or whatever, but the pet owner are, so you can really assess more clearly. And that's what I think a lot of people are just driven to distraction by. Like, I know we're near the end, but where is the end and how do I determine the end? So to me, it seems like the right thing would be to defer to the vet.
You're not emotionally sober is what I call it.
You
know, you just can't think straight. Like emotionally, you're just not sober and you need somebody to say, listen, I got you. You're in good hands. We're not going to make a decision that you aren't okay with.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that medication is delivered by my hand. So I'm not going to do something that I don't think is the very best thing to do. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's we've gotten some emails and some texts, and then we've got someone that's been holding on the phone here for us. So let's get others involved. Of course, they have many more questions, but let's get some other people involved in the conversation. Hi. You're on Talking Animals with Dr. Danny McVitie.
Yes. Hi. Great show, as always. This isn't exactly on the topic of end-of-life care, but I've always wanted to ask a thoughtful veterinarian about what the veterinary schools and the profession teaches about the egalitarianism or not of the human-animal relationship. And I think it does touch on your end-of-life and issue of pets being family. Just the very word pet and the whole legal construct of pet ownership and the fact that we, except in Oregon, don't even have the right to euthanize ourselves. But because, like with slavery, animals are viewed as property, not people, it puts a whole lot of trouble into human-animal relationships. They're a vertical hierarchy of ownership. And we get to decide when you die. You're totally dependent on us. And especially for, like, not dogs and cats, but other types of animals that don't so easily become domesticated and sycophantic to humans, but actually retain their wildness, it all gets quite murky. And it's an emotional and ethical issue. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, and especially what your profession is saying about this. I'll close with this by saying I've known two people who were in veterinary school who were vegans and are big activists for animal rights and animal sentience, and one quit veterinary school saying that the whole ideology of the veterinary profession at that school was, like you said earlier, animals are machines, they're our property, who cares really if they have a spiritual, emotional life? They're ours to do what we want.
Right, right. And what's your name?
My name is Steve.
Hi, Steve. Okay, no, and you, I love this conversation. I love the ethical discussions that we have in veterinary medicine. And I will tell you that we don't get a lot of ethical lectures, mainly because our curriculum is so jam-packed with biology and the actual ability to treat a disease that we don't kind of step back and say, just like in Jurassic Park, just because we can doesn't mean that we should sometimes. So I myself empathize with what you're saying. Right now, just as you said, pets are considered property. And if you look at a lot of the surveys that have done with the American Animal Hospital Association, the AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association, they will show you that upwards of 80% of people consider themselves a pet parent or a mom or a dad. Now, as a veterinarian, I would, you know, kind of put out there, what are the alternatives to being considered property at this time? I believe that as time goes on, we'll find a better way to handle that. But my fear is that they would be considered not property, something else, maybe like a sentient being or something. And then the decision to end suffering would be taken out of the hands of the veterinarian. And from my experience, even though, you know, the veterinarians are people, we're not all absolutely perfect. We have dedicated our lives to treating pets and doing the very, very best that we can do. In Portugal, I was speaking in Portugal in November of last year, and they just passed a law that says a veterinarian cannot euthanize a healthy animal. And I stood up in front of the Portuguese Veterinary Medical Association, and I said, if that law ever got pushed in front of the American Veterinary Medical Association, I would be the first one standing in front of that and saying, absolutely no way. Absolutely no way will you take away that right to decide from a veterinarian, because I know what happens if we don't make that decision. I've worked in the ER. I've worked in the academic situations. I see what happens when either families don't make the decision to euthanize quick enough. And again, it's not their fault. I can mitigate pain and suffering with medication. I can do that. That's okay. But what's even worse is when people take their pet home because they can't afford the medicine that I've just presented to them. And now you have a pet that's suffering at home strictly because they are able to take their pet home. And I can't step in and say, let's just do something. Now, this is obviously a very gray area, and there's lots of things that my veterinary profession can do a little bit better. There's a lot of gray areas that certain pet ownership people can do better at, like not cropping ears in a garage and, you know, stuff like that. So it really has to do with all parts of life and how all of us can step in and say, what is absolutely best for the pet? And how can we take our different viewpoints about it being best for the pet and then make the decision that is the greater good of everybody?
Stevie, thanks once again for a great call and a great question. Okay, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Danny McVitie, a veterinarian who co-founded Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice, a national company that specializes in end-of-life veterinary care. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So we have gotten some emails and texts. One of them is from Don Goldstein. He's our ongoing Greyhound correspondent here at Talking Hounds. But he says, from Don Goldstein, in my work with Greyhounds and their families, the biggest mistake people make is keeping the animal alive for the people's benefit and forget or disregard the dog's pain or quality of life. Thanks to Dr. McVitie for what she does.
Thank you. You know, I thousands and thousands of families I've helped, and I have not heard one person say I did it too soon. It's always, you know, I've waited just a little bit too long. And I say, you didn't.
I think that's part of the incredible struggle with us animal lovers is, like, you don't want to say goodbye too soon. Yeah. But you don't want to be selfish. But, like, again, we're in that gray area. And thank God we have you and your counterparts to play God, as you say. So
our team says it's better to help a friend a day too early than a second too late.
Mm. You know. So here's the text message. It says, we loved our experience with Lap of Love. Such a great way to be at peace with a loved one. Say goodbye to our beautiful 15-year-old Wheaton Jake in February. Highly recommend their service and thank you for all you do. This one, there might be one more, and then I'm going to get back. Hopefully it'll be my turn to ask more questions soon. I had to email instead of calling because I will cry. You put my darling Sky girl down 5 years ago in my lap. It was beautiful. Thank you. Plus I buried her in my own backyard. So, and again, that's the other thing is there's options of what you do after you have said goodbye to the animal.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah, there's cremation. There's even aquamation now, water-based cremation.
Wow. Yep. How does that work? What is that?
It's an alkaline hydrosis is what it's called. So there's either the fire-based cremation, which is normal, and then this aquamation is what it's called. It's just now entering the industry.
Wow. Yep. Okay, so don't want to run out of time before going to some basic things. We talked about some general things and specific things. But what are the most important things someone should know when they think a pet is approaching the end? First, let's talk a little bit about someone who might be approaching this for their first time. What are some basic things that you would advise someone who knows that's coming, they've never been through it before? How would you help them prepare?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very interesting trend that I've seen also is that people that are going through it the first time, because that's actually my first question I ask somebody is, have you ever been through this before?
Yeah.
And people that are going through it for the first time tend to wait too long. And that's not my opinion about it. That's what they say afterwards, because you're waiting for this handwritten note from your dog or cat saying, okay, mom, I'm ready now. And this one woman, she said to me, I've been looking for that note everywhere. I haven't found it. And I said, no, I know, I know. So when you're going through it for the first time, reaching out sooner rather than later is the very, very best thing that you can do, because you need to get a couple of tools in your brain of what I'm going to look for. You know, where does that quality of life stop and then the quality of death begin? You know, because this is again where Lap of Love evolved from, was in the emergency clinic, by me saying, right now we have the option of peaceful, compassionate, in-home end-of-life experience. You can be on the beach or in your backyard at sunset and everyone takes a shot of whiskey and I give the medication right after. Like, that's actually possible in the veterinary world. Mm-hmm. But if you wait too long, that decision will be taken from you and you'll be rushing to the emergency clinic at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's not a peaceful end-of-life experience. That's why I started this in the first place. So knowing when you have an option and what is most important is waiting too long so that you eke out every single last moment with your pet, or by making that decision maybe a little bit sooner than you necessarily want to, but wanting to say goodbye on a good day.
Right.
Saying goodbye when they are comfortable. Everyone says he's not suffering yet, but really the statement is you don't want him to be. That's why we have euthanasia, so they don't have to suffer in the first place.
And do all Lap of Love vets, when the time does come to say goodbye, are those all in-home euthanasias? Is that
everything we do is in the home.
Right.
And you do, as a veterinarian, you do not join a group like ours and not absolutely love it. You just don't. The doctors we have working with us are the ones that are called to do this. It is not a job to any of us. It's literally a calling. I can't say anything else other than that.
All right. Well, I'm going to skip ahead to another question I thought we might be later, but at the rate we're going, later is now. I think we touched on this 5 years ago, but now 5 years more, and with that many vets doing it, you said that vets don't join that kind of practice unless they love it. But saying goodbye to animals is obviously difficult and emotional. And for me, saying goodbye to Monty or my mother-in-law especially, and everybody like that. So it's not the same for the vet, because again, till you come over that day, you may not have any relationship with the people or the animal. Still,
it's emotional.
It's a very emotional thing that you're part of, and you're doing it one or more times a day, presumably. Mm-hmm. So how do you and your colleagues cope? Like, how do you...
It's a personality trait, Duncan.
Okay.
It really is. It's a personality trait that allows someone to walk into that type of situation and then walk out having shed tears, but get back in the car and just take a deep breath and kind of let it go and step into that next space. You know, people ask me that all the time, obviously,
it's
so hard for you.
Yeah.
And when I first started, I didn't know how to answer that question. I didn't have the tools to say, I enjoy this. I thought it was awful that I enjoyed and I got fulfillment from it. Not awful. I just didn't know how to verbalize it.
Mm-hmm.
This one family looked at me and the gentleman said, what an honor you have to sit here with us. And he was actually a client care coordinator at Moffitt Cancer Center.
Mm.
And, you know, he walks people through that process all the time.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and said, what an honor you have. And when I used to say, you know, gosh, I'm sure I'll be in therapy one day, or, you know, kind of joke about it a little bit, but I didn't have a statement until he said that to me. And now that's my response. When people say, this must be so hard for you, I say, no, this is an honor. You don't forget a moment of this, and I get to be a part of that memory for you. So it really is that way for all of us. There was this one quote that one of the doctors sent to me, and she goes, I trust you understand what few can. I leave an appointment with a trail of grieving people in my wake, and I feel a glow of satisfaction, rightness, and karmic return because I know that I've done good and profound work.
Hmm.
That was one of our doctors sent to me.
Well, like you say, I guess it would be a specific personality trait beyond them being obviously good, well-trained vets. I'm sure that there's just people that also are good, well-trained vets that just, even though they might do it in the normal course of a regular practice, could not do it routinely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but still, nonetheless, since you seem to have a good attitude and that person you met from Moffitt obviously kind of framed it in a really important way for you, do you still think, nonetheless, that over time there is some emotional wear and tear on you that, I mean, it's obviously not horrible or pronounced because you're carrying on and you're doing what you do, but... Still,
you know, I think that there's a difference between compassion fatigue, which is the phrase that we have in our profession, and then in any caring profession, which is do you get so fatigued by the caring of other people that you can't just care anymore? And compassion fatigue is, I think, what a lot of people think that that turns into. And that's absolutely a thing. You know, that occurs. And even emergency room nurses, because I lecture on this to veterinarians, emergency room nurses will report self-report compassion fatigue at about an 85% rate. Mm. But hospice nurses will self-report about 25 to 35%. And to me, the way that I look at it is that, because I worked in an ER, I mean, people come in and they want you to save their pet, and there is nothing that I can do. And I have to say that again and again and again, and I have to be there with them. They're grieving of that process. But when they come to me, the end is known. There's no fighting what's going to happen. I just simply get to walk with you through that path instead of saying, no, we're going this path. I know you want to go down that way, but we're not. And that's where really the fatigue comes from. So emergency room nurses and oncologists and people that really have to have that really tough conversation, to me, I think that they have a tougher job than I do. And they all say to me, I don't know what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah.
I mean, that's
so again, it is personalities. Absolutely. And just kind of how you're made.
You don't want a brain surgeon that's like okay with death. Necessarily. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you, I want the brain surgeon.
I'm looking for someone with a little better track record than that.
Well, they're just going to fight. Yeah, I want them to fight even when they shouldn't
like
be fighting.
Like you said, the oncologists, like they got to be those battlers. And and then sometimes what you said too, I mean, to me, unfortunately, there's a point occasionally where the end of life veterinary work that you and others do from Lap of Love and the emergency thing, like you don't know that your animal is as sick as it is. And I have a specific example that I'm not going to talk about because I will start crying. And all of a sudden, you know, you're saying goodbye, you know?
Yeah.
So, but you just went to take the vet to see how they were doing.
Yeah.
You know? So
and if you ask an emergency room doctor, they'll say, you know, I didn't get a thank you card for that 2 a.m. surgery that I did that saved the pet's life, but I got a thank you card for the euthanasia.
Yeah.
You know?
So here's another interesting question that came in by email. There's a few. It's hard to keep up with everything. And we're just in the last couple of minutes. By the way, if you just tuned in, you hopefully will catch up with this on the archives on talkinganimals.net. But I'm speaking with veterinarian Dr. Danny McVitie, who co-founded Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice, a national company that specializes in end-of-life veterinary care. So we're just in our last moment or two, but might be able to slide in one more call at 813-239-9663. And we do have some emails and texts that I'm going to probably have trouble keeping up with now. So here's an interesting one that came in. It says, what about those veterinarians who encourage clients to spend huge amounts of money to give a pet 1 or 2 months of chemotherapy life? Mm-hmm. Who decides how much to invest?
Absolutely. It's such a great question. And I've stepped in so many times when families have done that for one pet, and then now they go back for the second pet and they come to me and say, I don't want to do that again. Now, and that's everybody's decision. And we have amazing track record of medicine to provide to families right now. And you know, what I can tell you is that veterinarians are people too. We're people. And if you want somebody that is going to go fight, cure, you will find those people. And they're amazing at what they do. If you don't want to do that anymore, and if you say that that's too hard on you, because you know your pet's personality better than anybody. As a veterinarian, I will know the biology better than you will, but you know your pet's personality better.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't think that that's the best decision to make, you get to make that for your pet. And that's okay. And no veterinarian should make you feel guilty at all. That's my message to my profession, is we can't make people feel guilty for choosing something or not choosing something.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't allow that guilt to seep into you, because you have to understand that that's how that veterinarian practices medicine, and that's what makes them successful. And that's okay. Just choose a doctor just like you would choose a friend sometimes. Who's going to be on the same page with you on the page that you're on? So that may not be the page that you were on 2 years ago.
Right.
But you are now.
You're on a different page.
Absolutely.
And so you got to find that
and
person.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. So what about the idea of a household that has multiple animals and one, people are saying goodbye to one of those. What is the thoughts on having the other animals around at that moment?
Oh, is it fascinating what I've been able to be part of? It really is. I absolutely know that animals grieve. You know, do animals grieve? Yes, 100%. Now, they grieve in a canine way, in a feline way. There's this one gentleman that I euthanized his one dog, and then the other dog walked over the housemate and then started to go eating. The guy was bona fide mad. He goes, how dare she eat at a time like this? This is awful. She should be grieving, you know? And I had to remind him, you know, she's okay with this. They get the circle of life better than we do. We're the ones that have a problem with it. We question it. But just watch your pet and watch how they get through these things, and you'll find the perfect example of how to do it. Now, if you say goodbye to one of your housemates in a clinic, bring the collar back and let, you know, your other pet at home smell it. Let them smell a little lock of fur from the veterinary clinic. Let them smell the blanket that they were on. They're going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And also remember that sometimes they will be appearing to be grieving, but they're reacting more to your emotions than they are to their own. When you have a flu, how do they act? You know, mm-hmm. when you're sick, they're laying there with you all day. So if you lost a housemate and then they're laying there all day with you, you may think that they're grieving, but in reality, they're just plugged into you.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So one last thing. I mean, there's others, but one last one that we'll end on here is this text message says, absolutely awesome guest. That's the entire message. So I couldn't agree more. So we've been speaking with Dr. Danny McVitie from Lap of Love Veterinary Hospice. The website is lapoflove.com. And Dr. McVitie, thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals and coming
you,
in
Duncan.
And bringing the family and friends and everybody else. And so appreciate your work. And I think hopefully a lot of people got some great information and guidance here. So
yeah, thank you so much.
So in a few moments, I'll be talking with Paul Knapp about whale sounds and singing. And we'll hear a brief sampling of whale sounds Paul has recorded. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from Talking Animals favorite Brian Regan. This is an excerpt from a short appearance he made on the Comedy Central series, This Is Not Happening. This piece is Boo Sailboat, Part 1. From Brian Regan, today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Years ago, I was a campaign manager for a dog. I'm not lying. I was a campaign manager for a dog. I'm not making this up. You guys know, remember Bud Light had Spuds McKenzie? Yeah? Well, I wasn't qualified to be his campaign manager. But I was the campaign manager for Alex the dog from the Stroh's beer commercials. Now, Stroh's beer used to be one of the most popular beers in the country, and then I got involved. The Stroh's ads, they would have, Alex would go get beers for his owner, and everybody loved the ads, so they thought, let's capitalize on this, let's have him run for president of the United States. So, yeah. So Alex can't talk because he's a dog, so they thought, let's get like a funny campaign manager, and that's where I failed miserably. And what they would do is they want us to go around to different cities, and we had to do like 6, 7, 8 events a day with this dog, and I had to do this campaign speech to get this dog elected. I'm not exaggerating when I say that every single one of these events was worse than any hell gig I've ever done before or since. And I had like 8 a day. We would have to do radio stations. We wouldn't bring Alex because he's a dog and can't talk. And we'd show up and they'd go, where's Alex? And I'm like, well, I don't know if they told you, but Alex is a dog. He ain't got no vocal cords or nothing. I don't know if that's true, but he can't talk. And I said, I'm Brian, I'm his campaign manager. I'm gonna do all the talking. They go, ah. I'm like, damn. We go into the studio and they would have a microphone on the floor with a bowl of water, and they would say, we were hoping we get him to bark into the microphone. And I'm like, I gotta get a manager or something because I'm getting upstaged by a dog that ain't here.
That was Brian Regan with the piece called Boo Sailboat, Part 1, taken from his appearance on the Comedy Central series, This Is Not Happening. Now on to my conversation with Paul Knapp about whale sounds. Indeed, let's welcome Paul Knapp to Talk Animals. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for joining us. So let's get kind of a little bit of the load in here. When did you first record whale sounds, and what prompted you to do so?
Well, I guess the first recordings I started making were in 1984, but in the 70s, I was a fisherman living in St. Thomas, and then the Keys, and I also worked at 3 dive shops in the Keys, and I started listening to humpback whale singing there on the 33 and a third RPM record, Songs of the Humpback Whale. So I listened first on a record before I heard them live.
And those first things that you heard, were those ones that you yourself recorded, or did you hear other people's recordings and then say, hey, this is something I'd like to do?
Yes, that's what happened. In the 1970s, the Capitol record, The Songs of the Humpback Whale, came out. That was the first real awareness that we had that humpback whales sang, and that was Roger and Katie Payne's record on Capitol Records in the 70s.
Okay, cool. And just for the record, we're hearing some whale sounds recorded by Paul in the background here. It's Whales in a Chorus, in fact, is the actual name of the track from the CD that Paul has assembled with these sounds. So how often do you now find yourself recording the whales?
Well, I've been going to the Caribbean now for 30 winters, and I record whenever I hear something that is really great. You know, I try to filter out things that I don't really want to make a record of so much. A recording of so much.
Yeah.
But I listen all the time down there.
And so over those 30 years, in what ways have the sounds changed? Have they? I assume they probably have in some ways, but how have they, in what ways that you could sort of measure?
They definitely change a little bit every year. They change even in the course of one season. I don't know if I can really explain how they change exactly, but I think they just become more current and more relevant each year. When I listen to my old recordings, I do like and love them, but I especially like and love the newest recordings, the newest sound.
But is that partly or chiefly because they're just newer, or because they do sound differently to your ear after all the other years of hearing them?
Well, I think both. I mean, it's a new sound to me, but they definitely changed their song. They're well known to do that. Katie Payne in the 1970s is the one who really discovered that the whales changed their song every year, the humpback whale.
Yeah. But does that have some implications either for the whales or the environment or anything else, that the sounds have shifted in some ways?
We don't seem to know what is going on here at all with the changing of the song. Katie Payne herself at Cornell University, I think she's the top humpback whale researcher, song researcher in the world, and she doesn't really understand this either. So it's quite unknown, Duncan.
I see. So maybe we'll just give a moment and we'll turn this up and hear just the whale sounds themselves, and we'll stay quiet for a sec just so we can really kind of get more of a sense of what that sounds like. How many whales, by the way, would this represent right now?
I don't know. I didn't see any.
Okay. And Paul, over time, have you felt like you've developed a means to kind of interpret what those sounds mean, or if there's a certain kind of shift or an urgency to them, or have you been able to translate it all, even without obviously being able to verify it necessarily, but do you have a sense of what certain sounds mean?
Not really. You know, when I take people out in my boat in the Caribbean, I've been asking them lately to give like a one-word description of what they felt from listening to live singing. And words have come back to me like truthful and relevant, peaceful and calming and happiness and things like that. But more than that, I don't think they're not much is known, actually.
Right. Okay. I just didn't know if people that might be researchers or scientists have looked at what those kinds of sounds mean, and the way elephant sounds and other sounds out in the wild, you know, do get researched and start to be decoded to a certain way. I know that's not necessarily your emphasis, but I thought you might be aware of some, if there had been some research in that way.
They seem to know very little about what's going on here, Duncan.
Huh. Okay, interesting. Well, those cryptic whales, I guess, is what we're saying. So
they're very important, though, right now, especially for the environmental movement, because in the 1970s, the humpback whale was one of the catalysts that led the environmental movement of the 1970s.
Yeah.
And they can do it again. I mean, they are the voice of the ocean. There is no other voice, and they are in many ways the voice of the whole planet. So they're extremely important for us to, be aware of that, that this is our Earth, and these whales, can speak in their own way for the planet.
Yeah. Well, cool, Paul. Well, we're just sort of out of time now, but I appreciate you joining us and filling us in. And so I'm going to guess you'll be back the next year and the year after, probably recording more more whale sounds and singing.
I'm here in Florida all summer, and we'll go back to the Caribbean until, I don't know, November, December in there.
Right, I gotcha. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for providing us the audio supplement to these experiences. It's been cool to sort of hear these whales in a chorus and the whales singing in their inimitable way. So thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, too. Thank you.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lore and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint, with Nola Lole. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp presides over executive session. Meanwhile, on this show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a previous edition of the Talking Animals t-shirt. And in fact, let's get into that now. Name That Animal Tune is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days, and there'll be a prize. Again, the slightly previous model of the Talking Animals t-shirt. Again, the new one you can see by going to talkinganimals.net along with their other fun drive thank you gifts. And so we'll do that to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, reflecting a recurrent and recent, again, obsession of mine. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
In the desert, in the dry, before the breaking of the rain, the temperature in the shade had reached 110 again. In the desert, in the dry, on the overland,
all right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lore is up next with Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, June 7th, alongside my friend Laura Taylor, asking for your pledges. But please, please, please don't wait till then to donate in support of Talking Animals. Again, please go to talkinganimals.net right now for information about our exclusive thank you gifts, the new t-shirt, the Kauai condo, tickets, the amazing tickets to see Paul McCartney in Tampa here coming up, and more. And it's also where there's audio archives, links to our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and more. So I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Community conscious radio, homegrown, handpicked music and news. Thanks so much.